Good day, everyone. I'm Christine Vinatieri-Erickson with the South Dakota Auto Dealers and South Dakota Trucking Association. We are your official podcast called Driveline. Today with me, I have some mentors, great gentlemen in the trucking industry that have really taken me under their wing and helped me along the process. And so I'm excited to introduce them to you all and talk trucking. First of all, we've got Paul Enos. He is the CEO of Nevada Trucking Association. Welcome, Paul.
Thanks, Christine.
We also have Tony Bradley, president and CEO of the Arizona Trucking Association. So three very different states. We've got South Dakota, Arizona, Nevada. Very, very different states. We all belong in the same kind of trucking regional group, the best group, I would argue. But through my time being here, the last 2.5 years, I have learned so much from you both. Really your expertise as we talk about zero emissions, EVs in the trucking industry, and what does that look like for our industry? And so I kind of want to just kick it off to, Paul and, Tony. Talk to me a little bit about this. What is your research showing? What are the issues we're seeing in the trucking industry? And what do our viewers need to know? And what does the general public need to know about EV trucking?
That sounds like a loaded question.
Very.
Right. You know, from our perspective, you know, EVs have been around for a while, but obviously California changed the conversation by putting the mandate that a certain number of EV vehicles, or zero emission vehicles, as they like to call them, had to be sold by year 2035. And that's, you know, I'd like to remind people here in the great state of Arizona that the reason they did that is because California is one of the worst polluters in the country. And so they've got some EPA deadlines that they need to meet. And so that 2035 coincidentally coincides with the deadline set by the EPA on what they need to do regarding their pollution. You know, and we get a lot of it here in Arizona. Quite frankly, 80% of our ozone non-attainment issues come from China, Mexico. It goes into the California basin and then floats on over to Arizona. So we're punished because of them. So we're very familiar with what's going on over there. But there's more to the story of why it happened. It's not just an environmental push from you know, the people that like to chain themselves to trees. It's a push by the EPA, and California's doing it in order to satisfy an EPA requirement. And that certainly doesn't make it right from our perspective. The technology is not, you know, there. In short sense, it's not there. And in the heavy truck space, it's a disaster. And with that, I'm happy to hand it over to Paul to see what he has to add to that.
You know, Tony, California, you're 100% right. You know, there's a lot of non-attainment issues there. You know, a lot of that comes from being the breadbasket of the world and tilling up soil. And, you know, that stuff tends to go up into the air. And that's why, you know, the Central Valley, you know, is one of the worst areas for non-attainment. But, you know, unfortunately, here in the Silver State, I live in Reno, the biggest little city in the world. And my Septembers, which are typically my favorite time of year, get ruined by the largest public health hazard in the country, and that is the unmanaged forests of California. You know, when you don't do anything there, when you don't go out and thin out the trees and remove a lot of that fuel, you get absolutely insane and uncontrollable wildfires. And that is something that we have dealt with. And you think about everything the trucking industry has done over the last 40 years to become cleaner, to reduce our emissions, to reduce that CO2 footprint that we have. And it gets wiped out with a season of wildfires in California. So, you know, when we talk about the environment, we talk about, you know, emissions, we're only looking at a little piece of the environment. And it's crazy because it is so complex and it is so complicated. We act as if CO2 is what is driving a warming trend when it is a tiny fraction of the overall issues that come about with climate change. Do we have climate change? Absolutely. Do we have man-made climate change that's affecting the whole globe and that is going to cause human beings and every creature on the earth to die in the next 10 years, as we've heard from some of the most fervent anti-fossil fuel advocates? Absolutely not.
Well, and I think you make a good point with that too. When we talk about the environment and EVs, right? It makes us feel good. We want to do something. We want to clean the air, have better emission output. But oftentimes the federal government comes in and makes those decisions with maybe not really getting the whole picture. And so, you know, one of the things that you guys have talked about at a few events I've been at is, you know, batteries. Let's talk about what's in those batteries. And so maybe it makes us feel good that we have zero emissions, but let's talk about how we, what's going in those batteries. How are they mined? No two batteries are the same, right? Let's show your book.
So, you know, this is kind of fun. So I'm from a town in northeastern Nevada called Elko, which is a mining ranching town, and not necessarily in aesthetic, but I think in spirit is as close to the Wild West as you will find anywhere in the country today. My old man was a gold miner. I actually worked in the gold mines in college. This is my hard hat that I wore when I worked for Newmont Gold Company. Every third car in Elko had the same bumper sticker. If it's not grown, it must be mined. And when we talk about CO2 and tailpipe emissions, or the emissions that are coming out of a stack of a truck, that is a tiny part of overall economic impact. And I would submit that the environmental challenges that come from mining, and the United States of America has the cleanest, most responsible mining industry in the world. But even here, those environmental impacts are very difficult to mitigate. You know, you have everything from pit lakes to reducing the water table to trying to go and mediate those big pits that have been dug out. You have issues with biodiversity. There are a myriad of issues that come from mining that are a lot more difficult to mitigate than CO2. And when you think about what our industry's done, you know, since 1988, and we all have this stat in our head because it's really important. Since 1988, the trucking industry has reduced our emissions. So that one vehicle in 1988, that one big rig, to equal those emissions would take 60 today. Now, some of that is because of the EPA and because of them moving the ball forward and saying, hey, you need to get better. You need to reduce your emissions. Truckers like reducing their emissions because reducing our emissions means we are reducing our fuel cost. Now, we have seen the overall cost of those trucks increase because of a lot of that technology that has been put on them. You know, we have DEF, we have particulate matter filters that all do their best to reduce what is going into the air. But when we're talking about making that movement from fossil fuels to electric vehicles, there are a myriad of economic, environmental, and operational challenges that come forward. And to me, those are things that are best decided by markets, not by government mandates.
Yeah, that's a great.
And I think a big part of what Paul touched on, but wasn't really talked about, is, you know, yes, Arizona is a mining state, copper capital. You know, it would take all the copper that we've mined through history to today to electrify the fleet, right? Think about that. That's in talking electrifying the grid, right? Copper to every home, copper, you know, that's a lot of copper. And the same environmentalists that want us to go to electric vehicles refuse to let us to permit for a mine. And so we've got the minerals, but they won't let us create a new mine. The other thing that's not talked about is who, so when we're talking about EVs, we're talking about rare earth minerals. And we're talking about rare earth minerals that don't exist here in the United States. They exist in Africa. They exist. I mean, they do. Some of them do exist in the United States. Paul's got a lithium mine there in Nevada that's on an Indian reservation that they won't let be touched. But when we're talking lithium mines in Africa, we're talking child labor. We're talking horrific, you know, circumstances. You know, and at what cost is it going to take? Social cost to have those minerals. China actually owns most of the rights to the minerals. So if we're talking about energy independence from the Middle East, we're going to be dependent on China, who's showing that they can be adversarial and cut that spigot off. So, you know, and by the way, one of my favorite statistics is a new EV has the environmental footprint of a ICE engine at 55,000 miles. So right off the lot, that EV has the environmental impact of 55,000 miles. And that's probably about the same time it's going to need to change its batteries. So, you know, if we're going to have the conversation, let's have the real conversation and look at all the things that are put into the equation. To Paul's point, and I remember when I took this job over 11 years ago, one of my members says, when our trucks go into LA, our particulate matter filters actually clean the air. Right. And that's the fact, right? We're cleaning the air. We have done such a good job of cleaning up our footprint. You don't see the black smoke coming out of our tailpipes, you know, and the impact of difference between a vehicle today and its emissions and a zero emissions vehicle is in the tenths to thousands of a tenth of a percent, right? So we're spending all this money to go to supposedly an improved technology that has a myriad of other challenges. That aren't discussed as we have this conversation. And I'm all about having the conversation, but let's be honest about what we're talking about.
Right.
And yeah, so Chris, go
ahead.
You know, there are some other things out there that actually contribute to a greater reduction of CO2 than electric vehicles. Yeah, you know, Attree is phenomenal. I love Rebecca Brewster and her team at the American Transportation Research Institute. They've done a number of studies on this. Tony Bradley is actually a member of the Research Advisory Committee representing Region 4 very well, I might add. And they look at what is the impact of electric vehicles and really what's the difference between that internal combustion engine, which is, you know, if you put that at the baseline of 100%, compare that to an EV, which only has a 30% reduction in CO2 emissions over the life cycle, and then compare that to an internal combustion engine truck that is run off renewable diesel. That emission savings is more than double what you get from an EV. Because today, when you burn a regular gallon of diesel that's made from crude oil, you put 22.34 pounds of CO2 into the air. With renewable diesel, which they are making a lot of. In fact, California has converted one of their biggest refineries, the Rodeo facility in Northern California, Phillips 66. They are now all renewable diesel. That renewable diesel gallon puts 7.89 pounds of CO2 into the air compared to that 22.34 from regular. There's still a lot of issues with renewable diesel in terms of where you get the feedstock, in terms of the cost of that feedstock, which is used cooking oil, which is soy, corn. And we can talk about all the inputs that go into that. You know, out here in the West, water is a lot more important than it is to our friends east of the Mississippi because we don't have a lot of it. The cost of that, the disparate sources of feedstock, it's not the same as putting a pump jack in the Permian Basin in Texas or in North Dakota up on the Bakken and just getting barrels and barrels and barrels of energy-dense energy out of the ground.
Right. Right. And I will say, you know, so in South Dakota, I represent both auto dealers and the truckers. And so the analogy I give a lot of times when we talk about weight, EVs are heavy. So if I have a hauler that needs to haul, how do we get our cars to the dealerships? Us, our guys and gals, they're the ones that haul them to our dealerships. So I now have an EV truck who is heavier, who has to carry EV vehicles to the dealership. Now, maybe they would have been able to get 8 on their trailer before. Now they're only getting maybe 3 or 4 based on weight road restrictions. So oftentimes I say, unless you're carrying feathers or pillows, EVs is just really, really difficult for the transportation industry because who pays in the end? The consumer. If you can only carry 3 vehicles versus 8, that cost is just continuing to skyrocket. And so, you know, we see an issue with that. Also, you know, South Dakota is not a carb state. I don't think either one of you are carb states either. And so that means we're going to get the last of whatever EVs, because they're going to ship them to states like California, Minnesota. And so it's going to be harder for states like us to hit those goals, those tailpipe emission goals, because we don't have the product. So my question to you, I'll open up, is there a space for EVs? Where does it make sense for EVs? I'll tell you, it's cold in South Dakota. I just bought a battery operated snowblower. I love it. It's a beast. It works amazing. However, you know, my life probably doesn't depend on that EV snowblower, electric snowblower. But where is the space for EVs, and where are we going to see that shift? Because the consumers have really spoke, you know, in my opinion, the only adopters are those early adopters. They're just, we're not seeing a huge shift.
I think what's interesting is, and it's unfortunate, is this is what happens when government picks winners and losers. And, you know, we were at a conference recently and they had the title of the session was The Messy Middle. And the guy was talking about how we're in this messy middle and everything's going to be fine. And my response was, no, the appropriate messy middle would have been us bridging technologies. And by that, doing a natural evolution and the, you know, just like the Prius did with the Toyota, it was revolutionary how they came up with a hybrid that extended the vehicle miles on that vehicle, right? 20, 30 years ago, a truck got 3 miles to the gallon. The Super Truck Challenge got us to 9-10 miles per gallon. Imagine what we could have done if we innovated instead of saying you've got to go EV. And you know, luckily we've got some great companies like Cummins is working on hydrogen. You know, we've got Nikola here in Arizona that are working on hydrogen. You know, hydrogen makes a lot more sense in the truck space than electric does because of the weight that you're discussing. Also the fueling time. I mean, the power needed. Arizona has the largest nuclear power plant in the country, but we don't have enough power. We'd need 46% more energy to do an electric fleet. Again, that's a fleet. That's something from ATRI that showed what every state would need. You know, we're not creating new energy sources. Nuclear was the last energy source created back in the 40s. And, you know, we haven't created anything new. So if we can't, you know, there's a war on coal. Coal plants are shutting down. Not shutting down. They're closing down in America and they're opening up in China. Right. And, you know, natural gas, they have the same problem. You know, it takes 10, 20 years to permit a nuclear facility, which is clean. So I think the government really missed the boat by picking the winner and loser instead of saying, hey, here's the challenge. Let's get to there. We could have extended the range of trucks and done far more for the environment than what we're doing right now under this EV mandate.
Right, right.
And, you know, Christine, when you look at the trucking industry, we are as diverse as the economy that we serve. And I don't doubt that there are some trucking companies out there that have a great use case for electric trucks where that makes sense for them. But once again, they should be able to choose that in terms of what is best for their operations, best for their business. You know, we are building right here in the Silver State, not just batteries for Teslas, but the new Tesla semi truck is being built and tested just 13 miles or so east of where I'm at right now. And we see the trucks running around. We actually had one of them at our Truck Driver Appreciation Week up at the scales at Truckee last September. And I had my dad there with me. So my dad went up and struck a conversation with the truck driver. And, you know, it's like, hey, how do you like this truck? And he said, hey, he loves it. It's great. It's not noisy. It's comfortable. It's one of the best trucks that he's driven. And then my old man said, who are you hauling for? Well, we're hauling for Pepsi. Well, what are you hauling for Pepsi? Potato chips.
My goodness.
Frito-Lay is also owned by Pepsi. So, hey, it makes sense. And, you know, maybe in those use cases, there are some ways where EVs make sense, but it's not going to make sense for everybody. And, you know, that's where, you know, Tony and I are in 100% agreement on that. You know, when government comes in and mandates things, it's not going to work for everyone. And, you know, I always tell people, you know, who accuse us of, you know, being partisan or, you know, being anti environment. It's no, we just need it to work. You know, we don't care, Republican, Democrat. Hey, if it's electric and it works for that particular person, great. But I know right now, going over Donner Summit, which is probably one of the most treacherous places to operate a truck in the entire United States. Going over Donner Summit right now, where you're, hey, having a heavier truck probably helps with the winds that they say are going to gust to 199 miles an hour. That's at least what they're saying. 10 to 15 feet of snow is what they're predicting this weekend. It'd be a little tough to get caught up there with an electric truck.
Right.
You know, when I talk to our OEMs who are selling the electric trucks and actually have to give you what the range is because they're giving those specs to dealers, you know, it's not blind like we've seen with some of the other auto manufacturers. They're telling me that with consistent grade and weather conditions, you can do 187 miles on a Class 8 electric vehicle. That won't get you from Reno to the Port of Oakland. So, and especially when you're dealing with inconsistent grades and variable weather.
Right, right.
And what they don't tell you is what is the charging station? It's right. Two diesel engines on a trailer in the middle of nowhere. Right. I mean, it's that's in the background. If you see that trailer, you see that portable charging station, it's two diesels, right? That are off highway diesels that are much different than on highway power gen. Right. It's hilarious. And if it wasn't so sad.
Well, right. And you know, Tony, for that, the only time we have ever switched our means of mobility away from diesel successfully has been nuclear on aircraft carriers and submarines, particularly there because you need a lot of water to make nuclear power plants work.
Right. Yeah. Well, I appreciate your insights on the EV. I want to transition just a little bit to a different topic. Now, I know, Tony, you are very fortunate. You do not have Paul, you don't have a legislative session this year, but there's always things that we're working on, things we're thinking about. Tony, you're in the thick of your legislative session. So talk to me a little bit about what are the legislative priorities for Arizona, Nevada? I'm sure they're very similar to South Dakota as well. And one segue into that is, did Arizona or Nevada pass any autonomous vehicle legislation over the last couple of years? And what does that look like in the trucking space?
All right. There's a lot to unpack there. Yes. Yeah. To your last question. So we, you know, under our previous governor, Governor Ducey, we've been a testing bed for autonomous vehicles. It started with an executive order that he had issued that was formalized 2.5-3 years ago that essentially said, if you're an AV company, you can come here and you can operate with a permit from the Arizona Department of Transportation. That brought, you know, trucking companies here. We had Too Simple was based here for a couple of years before its demise. We've got Waymo, we've got Google. If you go to downtown Phoenix right now, you can call a driverless Waymo to take you. Matter of fact, I was at my son's baseball practice and one of the ladies had to go have her son picked up and they're like, well, why don't you just get him a Waymo? They felt more comfortable with that, not having a driver in that situation picking up the daughter. And so we do have autonomous vehicles legislation. Interestingly enough, as a side note, there's a new organization called State Armor Action they're based out of Illinois, but the guy is in Texas, and he was running legislation that said if you had LIDAR that was made in China, the department couldn't register your vehicles. And so for those that don't know what LIDAR is, it's the sensing thing that spins on the top of a vehicle or not. It's a sensor. But that's how you have automatic braking. That's how you have lane collision avoidance. This guy's got a beef with China. And so that's had some legs for a little bit. But, you know, more people know about LIDAR now than ever before. But that would have crippled the autonomous vehicle space here in Arizona. and everybody would have had to figure out what component their LiDAR was made in, because you know, you order the system, you don't necessarily know where the component. We do live in a global marketplace. So that was an interesting side note to our autonomous vehicle scene here in Arizona. So with that, I'll let Paul answer, because I know that was just the last question you had.
You know, as I said, hey, we are blessed not to have a legislative session right now. But you know, in terms of autonomous vehicles, we are one of the first states in the country to pass legislation to allow, I think we were the first to allow autonomous vehicles to be operated. The first autonomous truck was the Freightliner Inspiration truck that they had big event back in 2015. I think Arizona, Ohio, a lot of other states have really tried to go out there and capture that market. We do still have testing here. We tried really hard when we were doing the regulations and the law that it was going to be a level playing field. And once again, it was going to be market forces that determined how things would work as opposed to government mandates, you know, like they have in a place like California, where they said, hey, you have to have, if you have an autonomous vehicle, you have to have not just one, but two drivers in the truck. And that driver every 30 seconds has to press a little button on the steering wheel, showing that they're paying attention. That's, you know, I got to drive in the streets of San Francisco on one of the Waymo trucks that actually delivered this beer in Colorado, the first, or it was Otto, sorry, it wasn't Waymo, Otto. The founder of that company, I think he's in prison, right? Sometimes that happens with some of these guys. You know, here's what I see with autonomous vehicles. I don't see them as replacements for a driver. The last thing I think any of us or colleagues want to do is represent robots as opposed to people. But where I see the biggest benefit with this kind of technology is that it creates a bigger safety cushion for truck drivers to have. And I love that idea, especially if it means putting those blood-sucking billboard plaintiff's attorneys out of business.
Don't hold back, Paul. Don't hold back.
You know, I think the best way that it was described to me for AVs was that it is revolutionary change at an evolutionary pace. And, you know, at the end of the day, you know, like Paul, we look at it as a safety supplement for our drivers, maybe some additional utilization for the vehicles. They may be able to, you know, get on 40, sleep in the sleeper berth, drive cross country, get to Chicago, you know, do that last mile. But we don't ever envision a scenario where there's not going to be a driver in that vehicle. I tell people that all the time.
Right. And, you know, I'm just ending my legislative session, and autonomous vehicles were a big topic in our session. We did just pass our first round of it. Most of that was being driven by the South Dakota retailers. They had a few folks that wanted that to come. You know, some were concerned about safety. Some are concerned about, you know, removing entry-level jobs for pizza deliveries and whatever. And then some were concerned about the safety of truck drivers and replacing those. And, you know, we just didn't have a concern with that. We feel like we're 80,000 truck drivers short nationwide, as we've seen the increase of additional drugs being legalized. That's hard on our business too. It really is.
You know, Chris, just, you know, the favorite part of this job for me is doing some of these intellectual exercises around technology and public policy.
Right.
And if you think about a truck driver who is moving a load of tequila or cigarettes or, you know, something that, you know, is expensive and could garner a nice little supplement in the black market. Imagine a truck driver not being in that truck, and somebody, because, hey, these trucks are designed to stop when there's an obstacle. You know, you step in front of that truck and all of a sudden, hey, you've hit the jackpot. So I don't foresee a time when you're not going to have a person in there, you know, keeping their eye on that load. For 60 years, we have had planes that can take off, fly, and land And every time I get on Southwest, there's not just one pilot, but there's two.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And you know, I would add on that, trains, they're on tracks, you know, in a dedicated lane, and they still have an engineer, right? We're talking, you know, and there's so much more that the driver does besides drive. You know, while we have a simplified term for it, driver, you know, they do a lot more than that.
Right, right. Yeah, I hear you. I agree. Okay, so one last question for you both. This is a softball. I think it's really, really important. You know, we are all membership-based organizations. Without our members, we are nothing. And so we are that voice and the advocacy. What can we do as state associations, and how can our members be more involved in making sure their voice is heard and their industry is really protected? We're one person, but how can state associations continue to help their members and the members continue to help us?
Ooh, you want to start with that one, Paul?
No, it was a softball question.
She set us up. She's like, this is the softball question, right?
It is. Come on.
In these roles, Christine, you know, I think it's good to, and I wish our politicians did this, to approach these kind of jobs with a servant's heart, where we're here to help our members, to help them at times be a shield in a storm when they're having to deal with a myriad of different government entities, when they're dealing with lawsuits, when there's regulations, or when there's legislation that is going to have a detrimental impact on their ability to do business. You know, that's how I think we can best serve our members. And you know what I like is getting that input. And sometimes that's hard. And sometimes we have to go out and, you know, try to draw a little more out of folks. I mean, you know, I get a new phone every 2 years, and my wife says the amount of work that you do on that thing, it's like it's 10 years old instead of two. Because, you know, hey, that's the tool. Always on the phone, always talking to our members, always, you know, talking to the people who can help make the trucking industry move a little better, do our jobs better, not at times have that sort of Damocles that's hanging over them. So to me, approaching it with the servant's heart, being there for our members, taking their input. I love this job. And not only do I love the job for the job itself, but the people are absolutely amazing. I mean, I'm looking at two people that are my work family right now. And, you know, we collaborate with each other. We work with each other. We're not in competition, even though we're doing the same jobs. And oftentimes we have the same members. We're not in competition with each other. There is a tremendous amount of collaboration and working together that goes on in this industry that I think makes our family different than any other trade associations I've seen.
Yeah, I agree with Paul. You know, I think one of the biggest challenges is a lot of the stuff that we do is stopping stuff before it starts, mm-hmm. right? And you don't really have to look much further than California. And I often, and very, you know, very frequently, I'm like, we don't want to become like California. And unfortunately, nobody has a monopoly on stupid ideas. So you can have a Republican legislator that can have a bad idea, a Democratic legislator that can have a bad idea. And sometimes they're just unintended consequences, but you have to educate your board. And, you know, there's 1,000 things we do a day that it just stops something before it starts. And so, you know, making sure you're showing your value, you know, is the best thing you can do. You know, make sure to share the story of the association, bring those people in that aren't part of it. And that's hard. I mean, there are unfortunately freeloaders in our industry that benefit from the work that we do, but you've got to appreciate your members all the more for that. And there's, you know, there's potentially problems coming because we've got a generational change happening, right? The previous generation, the baby boomers, they understood the value of the association. You know, millennials, not so much. And so you got to bring those people in, do programs to let them see the value so that they remain members. It's a challenge. It's something you got to think about every day, you know, and that's unfortunate, but you know, there's nothing like a good crisis, you know, to take advantage of. So if you have those issues, you know, remind them that, hey, you know, Illinois is near your state. They're looking at CARB. You don't want that to happen here. We're, we are the association that making sure that doesn't happen and educating those policymakers on why it's a bad idea to follow California's lead. So just use California. That's the golden rule there.
Hey, in South Dakota, California. We say that a lot. So
right. Don't California, my South Dakota should be on your t-shirt. Right?
No, it's usually we have the bumper
stickers, right? Don't Californicate my Nevada.
There you go. Well, ours usually says freedom. We are the state of freedom in South Dakota. We love our freedom. We stayed open during COVID and a lot of that was our truckers. So Paul Enos, CEO, Nevada Trucking Association, Tony Bradley, President, CEO of Arizona Trucking Association, truly two of my favorite people and mentors. Thank you so much for being here and sharing a little bit of what's going on in your states, as well as how we collaborate across state lines to making sure that we protect the industry as a whole. So good day, gentlemen.
Good work. You're doing great.
Godspeed, Christine. Thank you.